It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up, why immigration reform may still have a chance of clearing the House this session.
But first, with Iran in negotiations with six world powers, including the United States, to halt or at least slow the growth of their nuclear capabilities, there's been a failure to reach interim agreement. Now negotiations are set to pick up again on November 20th.
And that is the backdrop for our next guest. His new book takes stock of the last nine countries with nuclear programs, which hold between them 17,000 nuclear weapons.
Joseph Cernciony is with us now. He's the president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board and the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. Joseph, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I want to start by reading a bit from your book. It says, few people think about nuclear weapons. They believe the threats have ended or plans are in place to prevent nuclear catastrophe. They are dead wrong. Why do we, what is wrong with our thinking about nuclear weapons? Are we thinking in an outdated mode? Should we still be frightened?
Well, I think very few people wake up in the morning thinking about nuclear weapons. We generally think of these things as something left over from the Cold War. We assume that more or less they've been taken care of. If you think about them at all, maybe it's from a country like Iran. You worry that Iran might get a nuclear weapon. It's hard to avoid that. But that's seen as sort of a, you know, an isolated case. The truth is that these weapons pose multiple risks to us, not just that a new country like Iran could get them, not just that there could be a nuclear conflict in South Asia between India and Pakistan, who have about 200 nuclear weapons between them and have fought three wars over the last 60 years, but there's a danger from the existing stockpiles. These are the most powerful weapons ever created. One is capable of destroying a city. A dozen could destroy a nation, and a few hundred could cause disaster to the entire planet. And they're in the hands of fallible humans. People make mistakes. Things go wrong. Shuttles blow up. Fingers slip on switches. So as long as these nuclear weapons exist, as President Obama reminded us in Berlin this summer, no one is truly safe. We have to take much more urgent steps to reduce the threats from all these weapons in all these countries.
Now, there are nine countries that still have nuclear weapons today. Now, that's a pretty drastic decrease from what it used to be. And as a general rule, it seems as though many countries are reducing their nuclear stockpile. So that's good news, isn't it?
And that is the good news. You know, these threats, as serious as they are actually a small fraction of what they used to be, and it's because of policies that countries adopted. And many of these policies were championed by the United States. You know, John F. Kennedy famously worried that if something weren't done in the beginning of the 60s, we could end up with 15, 20, or 25 nations by the 1970s. And these were real concerns. These were countries like Sweden and Australia that had nuclear programs, Japan, Germany, countries we had just defeated in World War II, were thinking about nuclear programs. Well, fortunately for us, Kennedy and others acted. You know, they took steps to limit the testing of nuclear weapons, to start disarmament of nuclear weapons, and to build a non-proliferation regime that convinced most of those countries not to go nuclear in the first place. We still went through a Cold War where people built up to ridiculous levels of weaponry. There used to be 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, most held by the Soviet Union and the United States. And thanks to policies that were championed by Ronald Reagan, Herbert Walker Bush, and Bill Clinton, and now Barack Obama, Democrats and Republicans have helped slash those arsenals down. The trend is clearly down. There are fewer weapons in the world, fewer states with these weapons. In fact, more countries have given up weapons and programs in the last 25 years than have tried to get them.
Well, I want to go to Iran right now because that's sort of where the world's attention is focused in terms of nuclear programs. Where do we stand right now?
I'll be happy to tell you. By the way, I should give a caveat here. Although I'm on Secretary Kerry's International Security Advisory Board, these are purely my opinions, and I don't speak for the Department of Defense or the U.S. government in any way, which should be obvious. We are very close to a deal with Iran. In fact, and here's some breaking news, there's a story going out right now that it looks like Secretary Kerry may be heading back to Geneva on Tuesday for the next round of negotiations with the Iranians. We came very, very close last weekend to a deal with Iran. And this negotiations that are going on between the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, they call it the P5 plus one, and Iran. And they came excruciatingly close, but they couldn't quite go all the way. The Iranian negotiators had to go back to the capital, get new instructions. From what I understand, there is now solid agreement among the P5, including France, the UK, Russia, China, Germany, and the United States, and Iran on the text of an initial phase of an agreement. If this holds, we could see next week the signing of an historic deal, a deal that countries have been trying to get with Iran for 10 years and have failed. We could be on the edge of it.
Now, that would be big news indeed. Now, are you talking about an interim agreement, or are you talking about, you know, the whole enchilada?
Well, the whole nuclear enchilada. Well, it's that scene is too big a meal to eat all at once. You've got to go in phases. I had dinner with President Rouhani of Iran up in New York in September, and we asked him this question: why not go for a big deal all at once? And he said what many of his American counterparts were saying, that it's too complicated, that you have to take a simple step to build confidence that you can take the next two steps and so on and so on. So this deal is designed to go in phases. And the first phase will deal with the most urgent threat, the ability of Iran to break out and rush to build a nuclear weapon. Right now, Iran has enough nuclear material that if they decided to go for a weapon, they could probably get enough material for the core of a bomb within a matter of weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, something like that. It would take them many more months to actually build a crude nuclear device, and probably a year or so to have one that's deliverable by a plane or a truck. But that's still too short a period. So the deal would lengthen that breakout time. It would have them stop enriching uranium to what they call the 20% level, have them get rid of some of those stocks, lengthen the amount of time it would take them to break out. They would accept limits on their facilities. They would open up for more inspections. And in return, we would start loosening some of the sanctions, but not take apart the sanction regime. That's the first step. That would be followed by several more phases where we'd gradually start to roll back the program, and in return we would start rolling back the rest of the sanctions. We expect this whole process would take somewhere between 6 and 9 months.
Now, we've been watching as the Israelis and the French last week, you know, were saying of the interim agreement, you know, hang on, this isn't nearly enough. We're not getting enough for what we're giving. Now, do you think that the plan that you just outlined has addressed those fears and that can be something that's put to bed going forward?
I think it's addressed the French concerns. From what I understand, the French are now on board. There are some, and this includes Prime Minister Netanyahu, who have what they call a maximalist approach, that he doesn't want limits on the program. He wants the whole program abolished, you know, sort of the Carthage approach. You raise the whole structure and then salt the soil so it can never grow again. That is the ideal deal. He's not crazy to think that. You want to get rid of all the enrichment capabilities. It's just that it's not a deal you can get. There's no politician in Iran that could agree to that right now. So the phased approach is the most politically feasible approach at this time. You limit it, you start to constrain it, you build up confidence between the different parties, and make sure that you can verify every step of it. I think in the end, that approach has got so much support that it's going to prevail, including support among many members of Israel's military and intelligence apparatus. And in the end, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu will be satisfied with the verifiability of this arrangement.
Now, in your book, you write about how there have been voices in the past who have said, you know, we should just target these nuclear plants, we should destroy them. And, you know, on another note, the people saying in op-ed pieces that really the Iranian mullahs don't think like a Westerner would think. They are concerned with the afterlife and that we can't really count on Iran being rational about its nuclear weapons. Would this agreement, do you think, address those voices as well?
No. Those people who think that are not going to be satisfied by this agreement. So if you think that the Iranians are crazy, that they're irrational, that if they were able to build a bomb, they would, and if they had it, they would use it, no, this is not going to address your concern. The Iranians have been working on nuclear technology since the Shah, so for over four decades. Now, there is a base of knowledge in that country you cannot eradicate. You could not physically stop Iran from building a bomb unless you invaded the country and took it over. And that would require several hundred thousand U.S. troops, and it's not even clear that would even be enough. Well, there's no appetite in the United States for going to war with Iran. We are not going to do that. So the only way to do this, then, is to convince Iran that it's not in their interest. I think you can do that. There's lots of reasons for just Iran's point of view why building a bomb is not in their interest. And President Rouhani actually has said this. If we get a nuclear bomb, our neighbors are going to feel compelled to get it, and then we will lose the military advantage we currently have. Iran has got a conventional military force that can repel any invader. But if Saudi Arabia, for example, were to get a nuclear bomb, Iran would actually be less secure, more threatened. So there's solid security reasons for Iran not to get it. We want to add to those security arrangements. But if you think they're crazy, well, then that whole lane, that cost-benefit calculation doesn't really apply to them. I actually don't think there's any evidence that they're like that. People have thought this about countries in the past. They thought Stalin was crazy. They thought Mao was crazy. But it turns out that most of these states are actually rational actors, and they can be affected by a cost-benefit calculation. Some combination of pressures and incentive can convince these countries they can meet their goals by non-nuclear means, or if not, deter them from ever using a nuclear weapon they might have gotten.
Well, we're talking with Joseph Cernciony right now. He's the president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and he has a new book out. It's called Nuclear Nightmare, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late.
And we're taking your calls next. Do you think that the U.S. has taken enough of a leadership position against proliferation? What should that role be? And do you think we need nukes to keep the world safe? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And don't forget, you can also post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the continued threat of nuclear weapons in the world today with Joseph Cernciony. He's a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board. He has a new book out. It's called Nuclear Nightmares.
And we're taking your calls next. And what do you think about that threat these days? Does it feel different to you now than it may have felt, say, during the Cold War? Are nuclear weapons something to be taken seriously? And if so, how do we demonstrate that? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or give us a post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Joseph, leaving Iran for a moment, you say the real country to be worried about is Pakistan. Why Pakistan?
Pakistan already has 100 nuclear weapons. Iran might someday get one or two. They have enough material to build 100 more. They have a very weak government. They have a collapsing economy. They have strong Islamic fundamentalist influences in their military and intelligence apparatus. Oh, and they have Al-Qaeda operating inside the country, a group that wants to get a nuclear bomb. Plus, they have the ongoing conflict with India. So you have two worries. One is that a terrorist fundamentalist group could get a bomb. And terrorist groups, unlike states, cannot be deterred from using it. If Al-Qaeda got a nuclear weapon, it's pretty clear they would use it or threaten to use it. And the other worry is that some conflict could escalate out of control and there could be a regional nuclear war in South Asia. There's no other country that poses that complex of threats all at once. Pakistan could go from a major non-NATO ally of the United States to our worst nuclear nightmare overnight.
So given all that, are we focusing enough attention on Pakistan?
No, not nearly enough. And in fact, this is one area where I will invoke the International Security Advisory Board. We issued a report last year urging that we take much more steps to resolve the Pakistan situation, both their security situation, their economic situation, and the security of their weapons. They should be getting a lot more of the attention, even if we gave in a fraction of the attention we're devoting to Iran to Pakistan, we'd all be better off.
I'm going to go to the phones now. We've got a call from Rich in Bloomer. Hi, Rich.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I think he has a good idea of what with Pakistan, of what I've been hearing over the years. But then with the nuclear part, I remember when I was in the military in the 70s, where I was stationed in Europe, we really didn't think anything of it until we would get to another part of the country and hear what they had capabilities of doing. So if everyone went with the eliminate the nuclear weapons, but then all of a sudden the other countries know, okay, that country there, country A, they have the capability of making one, so as long as they don't make one, we really don't need one either. And, well, where I was in the early 70s was in West Berlin.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Rich. Joseph, what do you think?
Sure. So he's talking about the problem of if you try to reduce nuclear weapons and eventually eliminate them, what do you do about the bomb in the basement? What do you do if you wake up one day and after you've gotten rid of your nukes and Canada announces it has a nuclear weapon and wants to renegotiate the border between the two countries? As it turns out, that is really much less of a concern than you might imagine. The United States has formidable conventional military capability, which is enough to deter or respond to any threat, including a nuclear threat. And, of course, if something were to happen, you don't forget how to build nuclear weapons. You choose not to build nuclear weapons. You could always decide that the security situation shifted and you went back up. And that's why many, many people in the American security establishment, including like former Secretary of State George Shultz and former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, have urged us to move steadily towards a world without nuclear weapons, to get rid of these risks and reduce the chance that one of these weapons will be used someday by miscalculation, by accident, or by madness.
Now, Joseph, what do we need to do? What is step one for the United States and for the world at large to live in a world free of nuclear weapons?
Well, the United States and Russia have 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world. So if you're going to start reducing, that's the logical place to start. And President Obama and the President of Russia have recognized this, that these two countries have a special responsibility. So you don't have to decide you're going to get rid of all of them. You can decide you don't need this many of them. Do we really need to have 5,000 nuclear weapons in our active stockpile? It's hard to imagine a military mission that requires one nuclear weapon now, but maybe you need 10 or 50 or 500. If you could say, okay, let's go down to 500 and we'll do it in a verifiable agreement with Russia, you do the same, we do the same, that would be a huge step towards reducing the risks of using these weapons. Step two is then to involve the other countries in this process. So you bring China in and India and Pakistan, the UK, people who already have nuclear arsenals in the low hundreds, and you get them to stop making more and to start reducing them. And step three is then to get down to very low levels, a couple of dozen each, and then you can stop, take a look, and see if you can create the kind of inspection regime that would make each country comfortable getting rid of them altogether. This whole process would probably take something like 20 years.
Is this an all-or-nothing game in that everybody has to be on that page? Everyone has to agree that no one will make nuclear weapons or it doesn't work at all?
In the end, yes, it does. Everyone has to agree. But you know, as it turns out, we're a lot closer than we think. Most of the world has already agreed to this. There are 183 countries in the world that have signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that don't have nuclear weapons and have promised never to get them. And it's not that these countries couldn't. Germany could build a bomb. Japan could build a bomb in, 3 months. They choose not to. So most of the world is already there. And what you're looking at is still the nuclear wave that began with Hiroshima, that is built up during the Cold War, that is now receding. There are fewer and fewer weapons every day. We have to make sure that we get down to low levels quick enough to prevent any of them from being used. Can you get to zero? I think so, but you don't have to agree with that to realize that we'll be much safer just with every step we take towards that goal so nobody ever uses one of these things again.
All right, Joseph, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
We've been talking to Joseph Cerencioni. He's the president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, also a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board, and he's the author of Nuclear Nightmare, Securing the World Before It's Too Late.
Coming up, we'll find out why immigration reform legislation may still be alive and kicking in the House after all. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Look at immigration reform. On Wednesday of this week, Speaker of the House John Boehner said that the House had no intention of voting on the Senate's comprehensive immigration bill.
This, of course, upset immigration reform advocates and attracted some criticism from Vice President Joe Biden. And meanwhile, some Republicans in the House are showing interest in voting on their own versions of immigration reform.
It remains to be seen if the House will push forward with a piecemeal approach to immigration reform or if they'll take up the Senate's bill. Here to give an update on the prospects for reform is USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what Speaker Boehner said that would indicate, hey, things might be moving along after all. What did he say?
Yeah, on the bright side, there was he's made it clear throughout that he's pushing for this House approach, and you referenced this a second ago, that this piecemeal approach. And what that means is the Senate back in June, they passed this comprehensive sweeping bill that deals with every aspect of immigration law, providing a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, more border security, more visas for high-tech workers and low-skilled workers. But what they're doing in the House is doing this bit by bit, bill by bill. And so far they've been considering, it's been a series of five bills that they've been considering. And what he says is he's encouraging that process to continue. He wants the House to continue working on that process. So while a lot of people were focused on the fact that he does not have any intention whatsoever of taking up that Senate bill, there are some who at least look at the fact that he is continuing to push that House strategy and that he's still kind of pushing for that to go forward.
It sounds as though at this point he's kind of testing the water, seeing how many Republicans out there would support a piecemeal approach. What is he finding?
Well, I mean, it's very early in that process. I mean, the House is it's always been a very difficult place for an immigration reform to get through. That includes that pathway to citizenship. There's a lot of resistance to that in some of the more conservative corners of the House. But recently he asked Representative Jeff Denham, he's a Republican from California, to go out there and gauge the interests of House Republicans for any kind of immigration reform. So right now Denham is joining up with a couple of his colleagues, and they're circulating a letter amongst the Republicans in the House to see how much support there is to push for this. I mean, it might seem like it's a little late in the game for him to be figuring out how many Republicans are supportive of this, but at the same time, they have those bills lined up. He's asking to see what the appetite is out there for it, and so we should know in the next couple of weeks how many people sign on to that letter and whether it's enough to sway Boehner to go ahead and bring some of these bills that are teed up and ready to go, to bring them up to the floor.
Now, what is your sense on the answer to the question, why now? There are some people who have their own ideas, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's the last few months have been pretty difficult to get anything immigration related to even talk about it. The Senate passed their bill back in June, but ever since, I mean, think about it, we've had Syria, and that dominated the legislative calendar for several weeks. The government shutdown obviously just took all the air out of the room for quite a while. And so this is the first real break that they've had to do anything. There's been a big push for him to do something before the end of the year. But at this point, I think we're down to like 13 or 12 legislative days left in this year. So just the timing of it makes it a little bit difficult. But now is the first time that they have that little window to really kind of concentrate on something that is not the budget. You look at January 15th, and we're going to already start getting back into those budget fights. So this is one of the very few windows that they've had to jump into it.
Well, and another school of thought is that Republicans need to do something to indicate a show of good faith with Hispanic voters, and maybe doing a motion here would be just the thing.
No, absolutely. I mean, from the beginning of this last round of trying to get immigration reform passed, it started about a year ago, shortly after the elections in the Senate, when Republicans saw the beating that they took at the polls with Hispanics. The magic number remains 27%. That's the number of Hispanic voters that Mitt Romney got in the presidential election. And so ever since, they've felt that immigration reform is something that they need to do to at least, to not necessarily win over Hispanic voters, but to at least start having a better conversation with them, to be able to talk about things other than immigration with them. And so we've seen that from party leaders. We've seen that from the Senate. A lot of Republicans ended up voting for the immigration bill in the Senate. It's just this House that even though there's a lot of people in there who are supportive of this and recognize that they need to do something to get right by those Hispanic voters, it's still the House, and there's still a lot of resistance. So that's why it's taken so long to even get to this point.
Now, you mentioned that the approach coming out of the House at this point is this piecemeal approach instead of the sweeping overhaul that the Senate put forward. So let's say that the Assembly does get these smaller bites of legislation through. Will any of this hold truck in the Senate, who has this more grand vision?
And that's really where we're going to see the biggest fights in Congress. I mean, what the House has done so far, they've passed or advanced five different bills. Three of them have to do with immigration enforcement. Two of them have to do with increasing the number of visas that we give to foreign workers. But they haven't so much as filed a bill that deals with that 11 million undocumented immigrants that are in the country, that gives them citizenship, any kind of legal status. They're still working their way through that. And the Senate has made very clear that they wouldn't consider anything that doesn't include a pathway to citizenship for those undocumented immigrants. So we're still a world that they're still very, very far apart on that, and that's what's going to make things tough to get an eventual resolution.
Now, in terms of pressure on House Republicans, I've been reading about some protesters that have been going on, hunger strikes and marches. Are these having any effect?
I mean, it's always hard to tell, but I mean, I think one of the most interesting ones was earlier this week. There's no secret in town about where John Boehner loves to go to breakfast every morning. And so a bunch of immigrant children just kind of cornered him there as he was having his breakfast and started sharing some of their stories with him, explaining to them parents of families of theirs, relatives of theirs that have been deported. And he, kind of uncomfortably turned around and listened to their stories and was explaining to them that he's still trying to get this done. It's impossible for them not to sort of feel that pressure. There's a hunger strike that started this week right on the National Mall across the street from the Capitol building, and that's been getting a lot of attention. They're getting a lot of folks out there. There's protests going on in different ways around the country on this. So they have to notice it. What effect it's having, who knows? I mean, that's really hard to tell because it's a lot of these members of Congress, they of the House specifically. I mean, they don't necessarily have a lot of Hispanics in their district. It's not such an immediate pressing issue for them. So for a lot of them, it's easy to kind of look the other way. But the pressure is still there. I mean, all the advocates are really kind of putting on the push in these last couple of months of the year. So they're at least hearing it.
Now, you pointed out that we're well into the session here, not a whole lot of time left. Let's say that nothing happens, but there is this sort of motion to see whether there's some support there. Is even that enough to curry some favor?
That's a great question. I mean, and I think when you look at it that way, somebody like Senator Marco Rubio from Florida will be an interesting test case in terms of how he's received. He pushed really hard. They got a bill through to the Senate, but ultimately, if they fail to pass any sort of immigration reform through Congress, how much does that really help with Hispanic voters? Because where we stand right now, the Senate has done its part. They passed a bill. The president has pushed for it. He hasn't exactly been out there every day talking about this, but he's been pushing for it pretty hard. So at the end, if it ends up being the House that stops this, then any sort of attempts that Republicans have made to pass this, you have to question whether that's going to be enough to sway any Hispanic voters. They've seen some Republicans take the lead. They've seen McCain, they've seen Jeff Flake from Arizona, Marco Rubio from Florida, and some other Republicans really making the push for immigration reform. But if it's the House Republicans that end up killing this thing, then it becomes pretty hard to sell that, hey, we gave it a good shot, right?
Well, Alan Gomez, we'll keep watching it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Today it's Food Friday, and we're gearing up for family holiday meals and talking about what we're calling orphan dishes. These are those menu items that every year somebody makes them because you have to make them.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's
then
tradition.
There they sit at the end of the day, hardly touched on the table.
Unloved and uneaten.
Forgotten,
which
abandoned.
Which is no way for a dish to go through life, you know?
Yeah, we've had our share of those at the holiday table. Someone, I'm not going to name any names here, but someone served a dish of tropical parsnips.
Really?
And someone, Amanda Magnus, commented that those words just don't belong together in a sentence. And I would have to agree. So we have some alternatives to those. I don't know if you've got one, Gene, that you're hoping for a little fixer-upper.
Well, I was thinking about this. In our family, there are factions, you know, so they're not pure orphan dishes. There's usually one or two people that like a dish, and then nobody else will touch it. Turnips are a good example of that in our family. There is a small but enthusiastic cult following for turnips, and then the rest of the family wants nothing to do with them. Anyway, lots to talk about, and help us to hear to talk about these is Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Lori.
Hey, good afternoon.
It's good to have you along. Tell us about orphan dishes and why this is such a topic worth talking about.
Well, what got me thinking about it was something that my father insisted on making for every Thanksgiving dinner up until about the year 2000. It was a raw cranberry relish. And yeah,
I've had those.
Okay.
In fact, I think we eat those every Thanksgiving.
You'll have a raw. Okay. What's in your raw cranberry relish?
Well, you got to have oranges.
Oranges. Do you put apples in?
No apples. Sugar.
Okay. You do use sugar. Okay. I sat down and talked with my sister, and we both determined that Dad didn't use oranges and not enough sugar. Mm. So I sat down to try and come up with a raw cranberry relish that was actually palatable. My father insisted on making this every year, said this was the only way to eat cranberries, and then he, of course, was the only person who would eat it. Now, what I found was interesting. My father always made this by forcing the cranberries and the apples and the walnuts through his cast iron sausage grinder. Now, I do not have the cast iron sausage grinder. I have a food processor. So I put in apples and cranberries and oranges, blitzed it, tasted it, and thought, this tastes pretty good. What did I do differently from my dad? And then it suddenly occurred to me, I was using a food processor, not a iron grinder. Did a little bit of research online. The high acidity in cranberries can react with the iron and give your food a kind of an off taste.
Interesting.
Sure it would. It makes sense, actually.
So what I have discovered in getting ready for today is that, yes, raw cranberry relish can be quite tasty. The problem, of course, with raw cranberries is that when they are ground or blitzed in the food processor, they are going to release some juice. So I guess for me, you still need to cook them a little to get some of that juice from getting all over the plate. You want to get a little bit of the acidity working with some sugar or some maple syrup or whatever your sweetener is, to kind of gel it up and make it a little bit firmer, especially when you go for the infamous day after Thanksgiving turkey sandwich, usually eaten, you know, standing in front of the refrigerator just picking things out. You want to be able to slap some cranberry sauce on your sandwich and not have it run all over the kitchen floor.
Yeah, yours was a little sturdier. I can see that. It wouldn't run out the sides.
Right.
Some body.
So on the one hand, I was able to redeem my father's honor by, yes, raw cranberries will work, but you do have to do something about that extra juice, whether you drain it or you end up cooking it. But that might be something to save cranberries on your table. Now, both of you mentioned parsnips, turnips. Mm-hmm. You mentioned root vegetables. Now, of course, we're at the season when the root vegetables are in. We haven't had them all summer. So, of course, everybody is going to have their favorite dish that they want to bring to the table to celebrate the season. But a lot of times what happens with the vegetables that show up is that they probably are a little bit past when they should have been picked, if you waited until the very last minute to dig them out of the ground, if your turnips are a little bit woody, if your parsnips are large, their inner cores are going to be woody, and they're going to taste bitter. So the first thing you need to worry about with root vegetables is don't bring them when they're the size of a baseball bat.
So maybe pick the smaller ones.
Yep.
They maybe weather it a little better.
And if you do have bigger root vegetables, go ahead and chop them up. Look for any cores, especially in the middle of the vegetable, that might be a little bit tougher. Go ahead and cut those out. And then you can start working. What I brought in for everybody to try today were two ways of braising or glazing parsnips. One, I stole an idea from Odessa Piper from L'Etoile, who makes a marvelous cider syrup just by boiling down cider till it's lovely and thick. And so I boiled parsnips in cider. And the cider, you know, got all gooey and sweet and
clung. Those were good.
The other
syrupy.
Syrupy and delicious. And the other one I tried is a form of something that's called agrodolce, literally sweet and sour. You sprinkle a little sugar in your hot pan and let it caramelize. Throw in some butter, throw in your parsnips, then throw in some balsamic vinegar. And let it talk to itself for 20 minutes. And there might be something that you don't often find on your Thanksgiving table is something with a little more umami. Mm. So it does make a really nice counterpart to the gravy and the butter-laden mashed potatoes and everything else that's going to be on a Thanksgiving plate.
Now, Rob couldn't be with us today. He's got the day off. But he knew we were doing this topic, and he wanted to make sure that everybody knows he needs help with yams. Now, yams are a staple of the holiday table. What advice do you have for Rob?
First of all, you do need to make the distinction that yams and sweet potatoes are different things.
That's a constant sort. Actually, that is a debate we've had at our family table.
Okay, to cut to the chase.
Let's cut to the chase.
Yams are a starchier tuber that are absolutely wonderful in certain Asian and African dishes, but in America, what you want to be working with is a sweet potato. And Rob told me his favorite way of playing with sweet potatoes is just to roast them. But apparently that's not something that gets a great deal of enthusiasm, you know, just roasted with butter or brown sugar. So what I did was I cut one sweet potato up in wedges, as though you were going to do oven fries, French fries.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this great suggestion for a spice blend: fennel seed, coriander seed, red pepper flakes, and just a little bit of oregano. Now, that's not normally an herb that comes up on the Thanksgiving table.
It's an interesting mix.
But mm-hmm. all of those spices, especially if you're using a red pepper like Aleppo that has a citrus kick to it, all of those spices are going to have some hint of orange either in their smell or in their taste. So you've got the orange thing going. Orange plays beautifully with sweet potatoes. You got that spice rub for your wedge of sweet potatoes. You toss it with a little bit of light vegetable oil, bake them in the oven for 20 minutes, and they're beautiful. And the other thing I found, oddly enough, I had some of that raw cranberry mix left over. I mixed that with another just simply baked sweet potato, and I tried it without sugar, thinking, well, I may have to add some maple syrup or brown sugar. I thought it was absolutely perfect. No sugar added. So go ahead and add cranberries, apples, oranges to your roasted sweet potatoes, and you've got a high-fiber, much lower-calorie side dish, which just might be a way to get your kids to the table.
And it had a little crunch to it. I liked that part about that combination. And also the sweet potato, I'm going to call them fries, they were really good. And I'm surprised that they didn't have cumin. I thought they were going to be cuminy.
And, of course, when you're working with whole spices, you can sit and make up your own blends. This was a suggestion that I found in Gourmet magazine, and I was a little hesitant at first, tried a few things on my own, and I ended up coming back to their suggestions. I thought it was a marvelous blend.
Yeah, that was a nice one. Well, I want to ask you about another one of these veggies that some people love and some people roll their eyes at, Brussels sprouts. Now,
I like Brussels sprouts.
I'm a recent convert to the Brussels sprout. In fact, I've always been kind of so-so about them. Lori brought in hers today, and I was telling the producers, oh, they're so good, and then it turned out I'd eaten them all. So, yes.
Well,
tell us about how to save Brussels sprouts.
Well, for me, what saves a Brussels sprout is playing up the crunch. Rather than boiling the dickens out of it, you want to sear it in a hot pan just on one side. Don't burn them, just get them brown, and then you can toss them with either bacon fat or what I did for you, truffle oil.
It was so perfect. Lori, thank you so much for joining us and for making those Brussels sprouts. That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies.